This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg.
Join us now for the second part of our two-part program.
We speak with Stuart Schrader, author of Badges Without Borders, How Global Counterinsurgency Transformed American Policing. Professor Schrader teaches courses in Africana Studies, International Studies, and Sociology at Johns Hopkins University, where he is Associate Director of the Program on Racism, Immigration, and Citizenship. It is commonplace these days to cite James Baldwin's line on the police, you know the one, a white police officer in Harlem is an occupying soldier, he wrote in Fifth Avenue Uptown, an Esquire essay from July 1960. Talk about the role that race plays. Certainly, it's always been my belief that a fundamental license that the U.S. has ideologically for its endeavors abroad in Africa and so many other places. Of course, there's the financial and monetary exploitation and exploitation of resources, but what enables them to do that and police the way they have abroad, I've always felt that white supremacy and white nationalism are the foundation upon which these mechanisms of counterinsurgency and repression are built, and that it's so vividly played out in Vietnam and indeed in Latin America, etc. But I wonder if that's also your thought and if some of the ways in which that was dealt with abroad, how indeed any different or the same attitudes of supremacy.
Well, I think it's absolutely fundamental that we think of policing and racism as deeply intertwined. I think it's also important to recognize, you know, Malcolm X has this famous line where he says something like, racism is like a Cadillac. They bring out a new model every year. Racism changes over time. The history of racism in the United States is a history, to quote another great African-American intellectual, Amiri Baraka, you know, he uses the phrase changing same. So racism, there's something that remains the same, of course, at its core, but there are also innovations, renovations of racism over time. We should also understand policing in a similar light. Policing is not static. They adopt new technologies, but they change the way that they operate, the way that they're organized. And certainly, it's quite clear that one of the ways that police have changed is that police forces have become much more diverse. In New York City, at the patrol level, more than 50% of the police are not white. It's a little bit different when we look at the command level and absolutely different when we look at union leadership. It's important for us to try to wrestle with what might seem a little bit like a paradox, which is that the officers might be able to maintain an unequal racial order, a hierarchy, which we might call, as you have, white supremacy, but the officers who are doing that might not themselves actually be white. One of the ways that we can get a handle on this is to look at this history that I examine in the book of police experts from the United States training police and assisting police in other countries around the globe, in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. In those countries, the police who are doing the work of maintaining order and preventing a socialist or communist revolution, those police are police who look just like the people they're policing. They are native to those countries. The United States only gives them assistance and lessons. The United States does not send its police to actually do the policing in those countries. And that's a really dramatic difference from some of the other colonial empires, where there were oftentimes, you know, extensive colonial armies sent to other countries where they looked very different from the colonized. In the United States model, the people who are doing the policing and the people who are policed look the same, they speak the same language, they have the same cultural and oftentimes religious backgrounds, right? So this model of using police to maintain on a global scale a system that we might refer to as a white supremacist system or a racist system on a global scale, I think provides some lessons for police as they are starting to diversify police forces within the United States. I don't think that the diversifying of the police forces has necessarily meant that those police forces have not been instrumental to maintaining white supremacy, to maintaining racist rule. And oftentimes in many cities, a color line still exists in practice. And that color line in cities shapes police deployments. It doesn't mean that the police themselves have to be white to enforce the color line, but the kind of racial geography of cities guides how commanders deploy police resources. And that remains true to this day.
Another very important element in your book, an area that you look at in Badges Without Borders, you begin to illustrate precisely how the military-industrial complex and the prison-industrial complex came together through law enforcement in an attempt to really crush anti-racist and anti-colonial activists here and abroad. Talk more about that.
The key transformation that happened in 1968 in the United States was that Congress passed the Omnibus Safe Streets and Crime Control Act, a massive bill that inaugurated in a really robust way what was referred to at the time as the war on crime. There was an earlier piece of legislation in 1965 that got it started, but it didn't really take effect until this legislation in 1968. This 1968 crime bill created a new agency called the Law Enforcement Assistance Administration, which was tasked with delivering money as well as expertise and technological innovation from Washington to all of the states around the country so that they could improve their policing systems. And the blueprints for this administrative bureaucracy, the LEAA, the blueprints I show in the book were really the Overseas Police Assistance Program, which did a very analogous thing. It took resources, money, expertise, technology from Washington and delivered them to countries around the globe. The U.S. was already doing this type of training and upgrading of police overseas, so why not just do it at home? Take the expertise, take the resources that are available in Washington, and distribute them around the country. And over the next more than a decade, the LEAA distributed a huge amount of money, billions of dollars, to police across the country. In the very first year of the operation of the LEAA, a large portion of the money was spent on riot control technology. So again, CS gas that I mentioned before, riot helmets, riot shields, and so forth. In subsequent years, the expenditure shifted to different forms, but it really remained focused on policing, on upgrading policing. And the LEAA also helped facilitate some of the transfers of surplus materials from the military to civilian police forces. These, of course, have been in the news a great deal, and many people nowadays refer to the 1033 program, which is a program that is run by the Pentagon to distribute surplus materials to police. But in fact, going back again to the late 1960s and early 1970s, this was already happening under the auspices of the LEAA. So there's a pattern of wartime surplus material being sent to police at the orders of and at the facilitation of bureaucracies in Washington. It goes back to this moment in 1968 when, after the unrest that followed the assassination of Martin Luther King and after the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy, Congress responded to those traumatic events with this bill that really had nothing to do with those particular assassinations, but it was instead, they kind of used the national mourning to ram through this bill that would provide all sorts of new resources to police. In many cases, what was so crucial about the way this legislation was written was that it asked for any program that Washington funded at the local level to not just continue to grow, but also to continue to be funded with matching types of funds from, you know, local authorities. So it kind of baked into the system the logic of continue the funding and even expand the funding once Washington has primed the pump, so to speak, with its own funding. And so that leads to the really massive growth of what comes to be called the prison industrial complex or the carceral state over ensuing decades. And many scholars will argue that this leads directly to the rise of mass incarceration, which really gets going at the beginning of the 1980s.
We have nearly 700,000, I believe, police officers in the United States, which amounts to about 2 for every 1,000 people. Now, we are the victims certainly of police brutality are so disproportionately black teenage boys, for the most part, young men. How are we to take up these issues given how deeply rooted it is, which is your whole premise, honed in international relationships, a fundamental part of really monopoly capitalism and its development? How are we then to take this occupying army, which has been so militarized and whose skills have been honed through U.S. endeavors abroad, U.S. counterinsurgency, then came home to our various police departments? What are we to do about stop and frisk? What are we to do about the broken windows policing and the use of the military-grade weapons in U.S. cities that, again, have their roots in national security policy, in effect? How would you look at what should be the kinds of demands and the ways? Is anything short of, or is it just about absolutely dismantling, pulling out root and branch from the soil it was nurtured in, everything about policing, which has little to nothing to do about securing the individual safety and health of members of our communities?
I think that it's important not to make a hard divide between the goal of, as you say, pulling out, you know, root and branch and incremental change. You know, when you talk about something like broken windows policing, which is the policing of small, low-level misdemeanor offenses under the principle that doing that will prevent more serious offenses, first of all, it's clear that this doesn't actually work. And second of all, it's clear that this has really negative consequences for people's lives because these interactions with the criminal punishment system based on low-level offenses can really tremendously disrupt and interfere with people's lives. So the answer, therefore, is have police stop policing these low-level offenses. I think that that is a demand that is practical and wholly within reach. Another demand that you mentioned related to military-grade weapons, absolutely. I think this is tangible. It's clear. It would be entirely possible for Congress to get rid of the 1033 program. It would be entirely possible for the Pentagon, in fact, to actually recall many of the weapons, surplus weapons, that the Pentagon has delivered to police forces, because actually the way that the law is written, a whole lot of those weapons actually remain the property of the Pentagon. They don't become the property of the police forces. Some do, but many of them don't. So the Pentagon could just say, we want those back, and the police forces would have to give them back. But even more broadly, yeah, Congress could rewrite the authorizing legislation. That wouldn't necessarily prevent police forces from actually purchasing on their own military-grade weapons or sound cannons or tear gas, but at a local level, city councils, as many have been discussing recently, city councils could write new legislation that says our police forces in our city cannot purchase tear gas, cannot purchase sound cannons, and so on. So all of these types of goals are actually, when we break them down, they're within reach, And they point to the kind of practical dimensions of the broader call for defunding police. The real goal embedded in that call is to reduce the scope and scale of policing, to reduce the number of interactions between members of the public and police officers. You know, the idea, therefore, is that there should be other types of people who have different training, who are not authorized by the state to use lethal force. Those should be the people who are responding to many emergency calls, because as I think many people know, the vast majority of emergency calls don't have anything to do with violent crime or even felony offenses, and therefore don't require somebody showing up who's authorized to use lethal force to fire a gun and so forth. And so the call for defunding police, some people have responded and said, well, this means that we need to now fund a whole wide array of newly trained and equipped other types of bureaucracies. And I think that's exactly right. And the worry is that simply defunding the police will not be enough. And that may be true, but that's, I think, where we can start talking about the international sphere again and look at the Pentagon budget and perhaps some of the shortfalls that exist in municipal budgets that don't allow the funding of other types of social services could actually be made up with cut to the Pentagon budget. And some people have, of course, been proposing that. So I do see these issues as all intertwined. I don't think the enormity of the issue should lead to paralysis. I think it should lead us to action, because there's actually a lot of room for really transformative change in very tangible, palpable, and practical ways. What is needed is political will and, in fact, the courage of legislators to make these changes and to not respond to a call for defunding the police by invoking fear of crime or dangerousness or something like that, which has so often been the response. Instead, it's really important to take seriously that not defunding the police is itself dangerous.
You know, one of the last things that we just skirted through and really would like some thought on this, that while your book absolutely reveals NYPD's like global footprint, how U.S. counterinsurgency came home to the U.S. police departments, etc. The issue, though, of spying and high-tech surveillance, along with, of course, there's the vicious crowd and riot control and special weapons and assault, some of which we've spoken about, but the actual surveillance that is in effect, which has led to our having political prisoners, people being lied about, people being taken out of their communities, people being imprisoned for life sentences, people indeed being killed, groups even like the Quakers being surveilled and so on. How does that element also form a strategic part of contemporary policing, and that is the activists, the resistors, the community organizers, the peacemakers indeed, who are as part and parcel of the policing that goes on, a strategic component of how the police function?
Yeah, absolutely. Surveillance is a huge part of it. My book is about the period from 1945 to 1975, when, of course, there was a great amount of political surveillance happening in the United States. But all of the historical figures that I look at, I think, would be absolutely astonished at the technological capabilities that exist today for surveillance. That is a real concern in general. On the one hand, we've seen over time the evisceration of what many people think of as Fourth Amendment protections by the courts. And on the other hand, we've seen the increased technological capabilities that allow forms of surveillance. So activists today, I think in general, are aware of the ways that police are engaging in surveillance and oftentimes are quite careful. But I would also say that there's probably no amount of carefulness that would be too much, because surveillance is real and it's happening. At the same time, I would also suggest that the evidence indicates that police are collecting so much information and following up on kind of wild, you know, rumors and innuendo that they themselves are oftentimes misleading themselves because they're paranoid and they're collecting what seems to be intelligence, but is actually just kind of social media rumors. So there's a downside for police in the amount of information that they're able to collect, but that shouldn't mean that we are anything other than careful.
Given all that you've said, there is this controversy, which I'd like you to weigh in on. So are police workers, and are they workers such that their union organizations, their collective organizations, which are ideologically based as well as benefit entities for the particular members of the force, should the unions be repudiated? Are the police workers, should the unions similarly be disbanded or at least kicked out of the House of Labor, where many of their associations have been sheltered?
Yeah, I know that this has been a point of tension on the left in the labor movement. I don't really understand why the defense of police unions often takes the form of, if police unions aren't defended, then that opens the door to attacks on all unions. Because the history of the past several decades has been attacks on every other type of union other than police unions. So I'm not really sure what people are worried about. Police unions are not like other unions. They, of course, in some cases, they're covered by labor law that applies to other unions. But I think it's quite clear empirically that police unions are able to operate differently, and they're able to offer protections for their members that are oftentimes not available to other types of union members. And what makes police different is that no other union member is afforded the discretion to use lethal violence as part of their job, right? So, no, I don't think that we should consider police unions to be the same as any other unions. And no, I don't think that we should consider police the same as any other type of workers. Their work is violence. My colleague Nicole Siegel refers to police as violence workers. That is a very useful way to characterize it, and I think that should help us make a really clear distinction between other types of workers, other types of unions, and police. They are fundamentally different, and I think that it's not quite clear how laws around police unions are going to change. But what we are starting to see is elected officials or people running for office saying that they are not going to take donations or lobbying from police unions. And I think that is at least a start for starting to treat police unions as a different type of organization. To me, the way that police unions, particularly in New York City, have been operating and treating elected officials, intimidating elected officials, is really out of line and should not persist, and it needs to be called out as completely inappropriate, and it should actually open the door to starting to treat these police unions like a totally wholly different entity from the other types of unions in the trade union.
I really want to thank you for this incredibly important, provocative exchange. Your book is so important. It could not be more timely, and I look at it against the backdrop of the resistance to Trump's deployment of federal police in Portland, or federal troops coming into Portland to suppress the just uprising against really white supremacy there. As we close down, but with a reminder that you really need to read Stuart Schrader's Badges Without Borders. It's a stunning achievement. Is there a particular takeaway that you would like to summarize for us as we speak about this in the midst of, my goodness, the advent of and license, I think, of militias in this country?
of police, of course, doing what they historically do, which is blaming the victim, i.e. in James Blake's case, of course, that was true for Eric Garner and, 47 years ago in New York, Clifford Glover, the proverbial shining object that was never actually produced that gave justification and license for the killing of young black men primarily, but not exclusively. So the takeaway, particularly I will, with the federal government's administrations giving actually encouragement to extremists, to right-wing, virulent, armed extremists, what is what you'd like people to take away from your book?
Well, I think that what my book ultimately encourages its readers to do is not to separate the realm of foreign policy and national security from the realm of domestic urban policy and policing. We should think of the two as deeply intertwined. And I think ultimately that should lead us to dispense with American exceptionalism. And once we start to dispense with American exceptionalism, the idea that the United States is fundamentally unlike any other place on the globe, of course it is in some ways, but that doesn't mean that it's that in a sense it can't happen here. And so as we see the encouragement of violent, far-right militia activities, it should cause us to think about the extremist political violence that was characteristic of the Cold War, that has certainly persisted beyond the Cold War in other parts of the globe. It should be very alarming, and it should cause major concern for people in the United States. Analytically, we can get a great deal of mileage by refusing to insert what I would basically consider an artificial separation between the way policing is happening on American streets and in our cities and towns and the way that U.S. foreign policy and the national security state have operated overseas for decades.
Stuart Schrader, author of Badges Without Borders, How Global Counterinsurgency Transformed American Policing. Thank you for writing this book, which is a must-read if we are to properly formulate the kinds of demands that we need today to weed out the most vicious and violent forms of white supremacy.
Thank you very much. It's great to speak with you.
You've been listening to Building Bridges, produced by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. Stay strong and stay well.